Hello, everybody, and welcome to a transatlantic edition of Blogging Heads. We are very lucky today. We have the author, John Holzman of John Holzman Enterprises, and the author of, and I'm holding this up for the camera, The Godfather Doctrine with A. Wes Mitchell. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Eli. I'm glad we could make the technology work for us.
Absolutely. And you are talking to us from Berlin.
It's at the end of the day, my time, so yes. I mean, the Germans have been gone for, what, about 6 hours now. So I'm the last person working in Europe.
And so let's jump into it. What is the Godfather Doctrine? And kind of briefly describe how different foreign policy schools cohere with Sonny, Tom Hayden, and, of course, Michael Corleone.
Well, we started with the basic idea that we didn't want to write, Wes and I didn't want to write yet another book for 14 academics in Washington. In fact, our main criticism is just that, that they're cottage industries, that the realists, my friends, only read the National Interest, the liberal institutionalists, the Tom Hagen people only go to Council on Foreign Relations meetings, and the neocons tend to hang out around PNAC and the Weekly Standard, and never the twain shall meet. And the one group left out of this discussion is the group we should all be assiduously courting, which is the American public. As we say in the book, we're kind of the Ken Branagh view of Shakespeare. It should be for everybody. And
right.
if you don't connect to that broader audience, you're probably not either a good policy analyst or a very good actor. And so
right.
we tried really hard to write an analogy that would tie into American soft culture, which we think is horribly undermined. And what better analogy to describe the world at present than Francis Ford Coppola's wonderful movie, The Godfather. And so we start out by saying, is there a better example of a declining hegemon than Vito Corleone, the great Marlon Brando character, who, you know, even his clothes are a little old-fashioned, but he's managed this wonderful system of courting allies and keeping enemies at bay, of making stakeholders of people. And this is the Cold War American system, and we spend a lot of time in the book talking about the system as a grand success. But then out of nowhere, there's an attempt to destroy him, much as happened to America on September 11th. Virgil the Turk Salazzo, this third-rate thug, comes out of nowhere and attempts to whack the Don. And really the hinge point of the story is the hinge point of where we are right now. The three sons, the adopted son Tom Hagen, who's been this consigliere, is kind of the liberal institutionalist in our analogy. He's the Democrat, the Obama supporter. Sonny was born to be a neocon, in our view, the great James Caan character, who's the heir apparent to the Don's fortune and really wants to use the family arsenal to right things. And then the third son, who eventually triumphs in spite of really being the son really least equipped, it would seem, to deal with this, is Michael, who's been off dating the waspy girl and has been off fighting in the war when his dad didn't want him to. But he realizes one thing that nobody else in the film does. The times have fundamentally changed. As he says in the movie, even Pop knows his way of doing business is over forever. And it's that recognition of a changing world order that really leads to Michael's success in the first movie.
Mm. And walk us through a little bit. I mean, let me ask you, why is September 11th like the Virgil the Turk Salazzo's attempted assassination in other than it was bad for the Corleone family, and September 11th, of course, was very bad for the United States. But you know, you have at one point, you know, could we have gotten to him 10 years ago? And it seems like, well, yes, they could have, because we didn't know very much about counterterrorism until we didn't really take it seriously until after 9/11. And so it would seem that in terms of the rise of the ability of bad actors to wage asymmetric war, you know, it caught us unawares. But, I mean, walk me through that analogy at first.
Well, the first part, I think I'd actually agree with that. I mean, always at conferences when I was in Washington for the 10 years that I worked there, the panel on Saturday morning, as we call it, the hangover panel, after everyone had been out on Friday night, they always had one panel in the morning. And it was either on China, the rise of China, which is rather interesting, is now more important, or it was on asymmetric warfare, the rise of radical Islam. And people would dutifully go along, but you could tell by the placement of the panel, nobody knew very much about it, nobody thought very much about it, and although it was seen as a threat and people would dutifully show up, there wasn't a lot of intellectual capital really spent on that. And that's very similar to the movie. I mean, Virgil the Turk Salazzo has one meeting with the Don. He talks about, of course, narcotics. Could the Don move into narcotics, which are so lucrative? The Don, without giving it very much thought, says that no, he thinks that's immoral. And worse, from the Don's point of view, the police aren't going to put up with it, unlike gambling and some other things that they didn't really care about. And so without a whole lot of thought, he dismisses this concern and then is, of course, attacked. As to your point about timing, about asymmetric warfare, I mean, I think that, you know, if you listen to what bin Laden's saying, and I've had to do that for my sins for a number of years, he would say that, of course, they grew in sophistication in the interval between, say, the first World Trade Center attack and when they actually were successful. That, yes, there is an element of luck in this, but also there's an element of increased sophistication while the rest of us slept. So I do think the analogy works pretty well.
Well, if I may, I would counter with this, is that most of the analogies, I think, has to do in some ways with the changing great power politics, that we're coming out of an era of America being the dominant hegemon, and we're now in an era where we have multiple power centers, as you call it, BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China, as new rivals to the United States. And I think that I don't exactly see how. I mean, I think the United States got a lot better, has gotten a lot better since 9/11 at tracking Al Qaeda and preparing against asymmetric war. And that's not a Republican accomplishment or a Democrat accomplishment, a realist or a neoconservative accomplishment. That's just, you know, what happens when you have a great tragedy and you have lots of smart people, particularly in the military and the intelligence community, concentrating on asymmetric warfare. And, you know, we've gotten better at that. But, you know, what does that? That doesn't really necessarily get us on the same track as sort of America's position in the world. So tie those two things together, I guess.
Okay, the link in the movie makes the link explicitly more than in real life, though I can and I will make the link in real life.
Yeah.
The problem in the movie with the three boys is Sonny thinks the problem is the Turk, and that once they whack Salazzo in a straight-out military contest, their problems will be solved and everything goes back to normal. Tom thinks the problem is Sonny, which is the Democratic view of the neoconservatives. Once the horrible Bush administration is out of power, everything will go back to normal with the Allies now, and the lion will lie down with the lamb, and everything will be business as usual. But those are both fundamentally reactionary views. Only Michael sees that the Turk is the symptom and not the cause of the problem, because the other great families are not falling into line behind the Corleones as they have for the last 40, 50 years. They're protecting Salazzo. They're working with Salazzo. They're at least hedging their bets about Salazzo in a number of ways. And it's the rise of the Tattaglias and the Barzinis, as you rightfully say, who we say are the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Right.
It's the rise of these guys that's the real thing going on, the systemic change in what goes on. There's been the shock to the system administered by Salazzo, much as radical Islam has been the shock to the system in the world, you know, in the world community. And let's, you and I were both in Washington, let's not underrate this. It was a genuine shock to friends, to enemies, to people in the middle, and it caused everyone to think, how vulnerable is the United States? But this became a discussion that very quickly veered away from Salazzo, who's merely the immediate cause, to this larger issue, which is why aren't the other members of the five families doing what they've always done, which is fall into line grudgingly, grumpily, because they're too weak or because they don't have a better option. Doesn't matter, really. Why are they not falling into line as they've always done up to now? And that's really the key insight Michael has, that the world system itself is changing, that Salazzo is merely the symptom of this broader issue, which is far more important. So while Tom is chasing the neocons around, and while Sonny's preparing the family arsenal for the next whacking, Michael's the only one who sees, I got to worry about what the movie really hinges on in the end, how to deal with the Tattaglias, the Barzinis, because the world itself has changed. Again, his great line when he says, look, even Pop knows his ways are over, and there's that great scene between Brando and Pacino where they talk about things changing and the tragedy of that for the family. And, of course, it is a tragedy. The United States has run things, I think, wonderfully well. As I always say to Europeans, you have five options to run the world in the 20th century: the Kaiser, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, or the bumbling old United States. And anybody not picking America has been sitting in a cafe for too long.
Well, I totally agree with that. I mean, I would argue that's the argument today as well. I mean, would you rather have the Chinese or us running the world?
I would agree, Eli, but the only way to get to that world is to realize that they have increased power. It's not to say that they're going to run the world. I think if we manage things well, as we say in the book, the United States will still come on top, much as Michael still came on
first among equals, as you say. Let me get back to this. I mean, I guess I would say asymmetric warfare, not let's leave aside radical Islam for a second, just asymmetric warfare and the advances of the ability of small groups of people to do the kind of devastation and damage that we used to say only nation-state armies could do, presents a fundamental existential challenge to any nation-state. That is a separate problem, which I'm not necessarily disagreeing with, that of managing America's place in the world with rival powers. That, ultimately, the new world order is going to require, if civilians are going to be safe from people, from small groups of people who could get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, which is not a made-up problem, it's a serious issue, it's going to require advanced and competent customs services, advanced and competent local police, international agreements that really can provide some degree of serious transparency when it comes to these sensitive technologies. And all of those things require a world order kind of somewhat separate from another important question from my perspective and yours, which is, where is America? Let's keep American hegemony. Let's retain American influence in a changing place. And so I looked at I see 9/11 as a sort of shock. It's not so much to the sovereignty of America, but rather to all of us, or rather all nation states, and to look at the damage that a few dedicated individuals can do.
Let me say this, that the two things that Michael gets right are
right.
Similar to what you're saying. I mean, how he reconstructs this new order where he has less power than he did in the sunny days of the Cold War, but is still first among equals, is still primus inter pares, is the chairman of the board still of the five families, even if the Barzini and Tattaglia families are more important. He does two things right. One, the carrot. He realizes capitalism is absolutely the key to bringing these people back as stakeholders. And who's been the most helpful country to us right now in the world in terms of stimulus packages? Not our buddies in Europe, but our enemies, in quotes, in China. And the Chinese have done this not because they love us, but because it's utterly in their interest to do so, because they're a trillion into the treasury bonds, because we have, from Nixon on, pursued a policy that has so enmeshed them in our success that we're stuck with each other. This is a tremendous success.
Well, it's
American
like that's land war in Asia insurance.
Exactly. And
right,
and
no, it's a good thing, though. It's a good
it's
thing.
It's a great
nobody,
thing.
Nobody wants a land war.
And nobody talks about this, and it's an absolutely great thing. And what he says to the five families is similar. I'm going to cut you into Las Vegas gambling. I'm going to make you all rich legally beyond your wildest dreams.
Right.
And in doing so, as Emerson said, every man is a conservative after dinner. Nobody wants to start a war of set and order while they're making money, particularly a Chinese Communist Party whose legitimacy is largely based on continuing to deliver the goods. From 1979 to now, 300 million Chinese have joined the middle class, as many people as live in America. This is the reason they're still in power, and they know that. And so we have them as allies like Vegas gambling. On the other hand, as I say in the book, there is a stick, and it's Al-Qaeda, as you rightly mentioned. Al-Qaeda, which wants no order, which doesn't love the Chinese system or the Russians or the Arab states any more than they love the United States, which hates the entire international order. This is a unique opportunity to share this danger amongst each other, to actually work together to get things done, not based on some notion of common democracies or common values, when simply with the great powers, we're not going to have common values for the foreseeable future. So rather than worry about a utopia that may or may not exist someday, I leave Kant to decide that, Hegel and my friend Mr. Burke, rather than worry about that, Eli, I'm a public policy guy. I have to live in the immediate and maybe the medium term if I'm any good at my job. And in the medium term, I'm going to have to work with countries like China where we have to talk in terms of interests. And Michael does this to the families. He says, we have this common position in the world. I'm going to bring you on board to make you stakeholders. And if you directly threaten me, only then will I attack you. And that's very similar, I think, to the policy the United States should be pursuing right now.
Well, isn't that was Bush's policy. Bush was, I mean,
who, I would who, here we disagree.
With regard to China, there have been China hawks more prominent in the 1990s, but it was hardly a priority for the neoconservatives, and with the exception of sensitive technology transfers, which I think you would also agree there is a room for making sure maybe the Chinese don't get all of our supercomputer technology and so forth. The general parameters, as you've described the China policy, is something that Bush followed. I mean, I'm at the Washington Times now, And I can tell you that Bill Gertz, who's a China
officer. I know Bill.
Yeah, and you know he didn't like Bush's policy one bit on China.
And I would say, and I have said, I think we write in the book, but certainly I've written elsewhere, on the reason, in a way, China escaped the general neoconservative view of it's us versus them everywhere, which did, with the other rising powers and with the older states like Europe, cause more trouble, was, I think you're right, I don't think it was viewed as a great priority for neoconservatives, and we had Treasury secretaries running policy far more than in other areas of the world. And this goes back to the Clinton days, under Rubin even. And because of this, you have the system of enmeshing them, and at the same time, we've constructed an alliance structure around them without being explicitly anti-Chinese, because that would be a disaster, because some of our allies, in quotes, would choose to side with them. But the Chinese now confront a world where they're enmeshed with America, profitable beyond belief, and if they were to become a revolutionary power, they're surrounded by a Japan that's closer to America than ever, an India that's closer to America than ever, an Australia that's closer to America than ever. ASEAN is broadly on board, and South Korea, as you know, is a nightmare, but at least it's a long-term dysfunctional nightmare. It may be an unhappy marriage, but it's been a marriage for a long time. And because of this being downplayed, it's the one area in the world, and I think we say this, if not, I certainly have, that I think that the policy from Bush 1 through Clinton to Bush 2 has been remarkably consistent, realistic, and exactly with what I'd say. However, the problem with the rest of the Bush policy, and especially in the first term, though I don't want to parse the two-term thing too much, is that this approach of saying we're going it alone, we don't care what you say, did cost us badly, and that, like the Barzinis and the Tattaglias, if you say, if you're either with me or you're against me, all the people in between, which is most people in diplomacy, are going to make that calculation and see how you do. And that's indeed what happened to a lot of fence-sitters, like the Russians leap to mind, Arab states leap to mind, and frankly, living here in Europe, a good number of our European allies, in quotations, leap to mind. Mm-hmm. And trust me, that's still going on. I mean, that's, again, a criticism I make of Tom Hagen and Obama. For all the love, for all the charm, for all the nice suits, for all the talking to them nicely, they didn't give way on the G20 on a stimulus package. They didn't give way at NATO on putting more troops in Afghanistan. They made no movement to help with the nuclear proliferation dream of Obama, and they hate his policy on Turkey. How is that different than before? I'm flabbergasted at the good coverage in the States. I mean, to me, this is exactly the problem with the Tom Hagen view. Tom thought he got ahead because he wore the nicest suit in the room and was the smartest and most charming man. Nobody doubts that Obama would fit the bill on all those categories and that those things are important at the edges. But we see when it comes to it, the Germans have interests that have nothing to do with whether they like the President of the United States or not. And so in the end, Tom is so divorced power from the calculation that he ends up kidnapped by Sollozzo, predictably, who sends him back to talk to Sonny and Michael, totally condescendingly saying, you go work on what you have to work on. You're my errand boy, much as the international institutions now are wonderful errand boys, but don't get to make decisions.
There's a lot there that in what you just said. I would just say on the question of Germany, it's true that Germany has its own interest, and I've been working on a lot of a long kind of investigative piece on German trade with Iran, which raises that question, you know, which makes it very clear. But on fundamental issues, I can say with assurances, and you can say with assurance, that, you know, you don't have any doubt that, you know, every country has corruption, but we believe that on a national security service to security service level, our relationship with Germany is such that we can trust them to be the kind of important international stakeholder in a world where we have to look at asymmetric actors in a way that we didn't really need to before, because we know that small groups of people can do the damage of nation states. And I would argue that that's kind of would probably be a permanent feature of our security calculus in the world for some time to come, because even if radical Islam is defeated, there's no stopping some kind of, you know, uber James Bond villain or some sort of another group of, you know, determined people like you would see on the show 24, and that you're going to need strong national institutions, if not international institutions, to deal with that. I have no doubt that Germany, in that respect, is going to be a partner, and I also don't have much of a doubt that ultimately the Chinese and the Russians have an interest in those kinds of strong institutions as well. The problem is when you get to these rogue states. I mean, can you foresee a scenario where the Iranians would be a partner in this regard and not part of the problem? They use terrorism as part of their statecraft. Forget Iran for a second. What about North Korea? So when you have some states or gangs that sort of masquerade as states, that corrupts the international system in a really important way with regards to this new security challenge about asymmetric warfare. And in that respect, I think the neoconservatives, when they were talking about regime change, I mean, you know, we're not necessarily like hotheads like Sonny, because they feel emotionally, they feel that, you know, there's an emotional satisfaction to, you know, wiping people out or going at them that way. I think that they were instead voicing a rather inconvenient truth, which is that we need an international system on some of these basic points, and we're not going to have a very good one if we don't deal with rogues, you know, with both eyes open. And we are still there. I mean, what has all of our diplomacy with North Korea gotten us, other than another missile test and more bellicose rhetoric, and sadly more high-end trade, and you know, I mean, it's a serious problem.
Well, let me go through a lot of that. I mean, because there's a lot there. First, about Germany. Let's go back. We're almost arguing. I mean, I agree with you. I think that, of course, this is a problem, asymmetric warfare. But as we make clear in the book, we think the greatest problem is the change in the polarity of the system. Yeah. That we're moving to a multipolar world. The neocons, for a while, perhaps we lived in a unipolar world after the Cold War. I'll even buy that. And before, we lived in a bipolar world in the Cold War, after unipolar, now multipolar. And that, to us, is the fundamental challenge. Yes, asymmetric warfare, economic disaster, a number of other issues are very, very important, but the key strategic challenge is to try to build a system in this new multipolar era where we remain first among equals, where we get to set generally the norms and terms of what goes on. But the key is to do that, as Michael did, by bringing along other people based on their interests, not by trying to charm them, as Tom did, or use international institutions, as Obama is, to say, we should listen to you. Sure, listening is part of it, and being well-liked at the edges matters. But bottom line, what really matters is the interests of states, and making it, as we said, we're Asia, making it in the interests of the Chinese to be stakeholders and not a revolutionary power. And that's a 20, 30, 40-year process, but it's the only game in town, and to us that is overwhelmingly the number one problem confronting the United States today. So I would say that. As to Germany, and again, I have read you on this and agree and applaud you for it. But yes, of course, at the intel level, when we share with the Germans intelligence, it's far better than sharing. Pick a Middle Eastern state. You know, it works better. You're absolutely right. And part of that is the common values and the nature of our democratic regimes. Absolutely right. But as I said, let's talk brass tacks about the world. The Germans are against a stimulus package of any kind. The Germans are doing absolutely their own thing, even within Europe, and beggar thy neighbor policies, and could care less about a collective decision. The Germans are hedging on the Russians in a way that's worrying. The Germans have no policy to China. In fact, they have two, which is also the wrong number, one run by the foreign ministry, Mr. Steinmeier, the other by Mrs. Merkel, meaning they have none. In practice, the Germans have gutted their military to the point that they don't play ball there. When you look at what actually at a policy level the Germans can do on the issues that concern me more about this range of multipolarity, I wouldn't say they're an ally in the old-fashioned sense. They're not my enemy. They're not out to destroy me. They're not out to make my life miserable. But when it comes to actually solving problems on a number of fundamental and basic issues, many of the European allies are no longer allies in the Cold War sense of the term.
Okay.
I would surely argue that. They're not my enemy. I'm not going to war against them.
Yeah.
You know, there are limits. And as you say, on all kinds of other things, statecraft, intelligence, there's, you know, the aftermath of the Hamburg incident, they're very, very helpful. But bottom line, they are drifting to a position that is neither ally nor enemy, much as the Tattaglias and the Barzinis have. The French, for all that they have moved in a more pro-American direction, miraculously, still, you know, are doing it for their own very basic reasons that Sarkozy rather eloquently explains. We are going to have to live in a world where we have the rise of these states, where we still have the most power, where we still need to get things done. And the best way to do this, as Michael did, is to talk issues. Because there we can find common ground, as you rightly say, with the Chinese Jiangxing province in western China. They're terrified of a Muslim uprising there. This is a great place to work together. The Russians in the Caucasus, for all their thuggishness, have legitimate fears in their own Russia proper about radical Islam. This is a great place to work together. As to rogue states, this is a key realist distinction, and Michael makes it in the movie. The people who are actually out to destroy you, i.e. the Taliban, which is a great example in Afghanistan, we've got to destroy. We've got to know the difference between a revolutionary power and a rival power. That, to me, got all mixed up with both the neocons and with now Obama, this distinction between rival powers who, yes, in a perfect world, as the Chinese say, in 50 years, if we can dominate the world, wouldn't that be nice? But they don't worry about that day to day. They've got all right. kinds of other concerns day to day to worry about, versus someone that, as you say, you just simply can't negotiate with because we're not giving the Indians back Maine anytime soon. I can't give a caliphate to al-Qaeda anytime soon to buy them off because that would not be in anybody's interest and would be utter insanity. As such, I cannot negotiate with them. I have to destroy them. And Michael makes that clear distinction in the film. He gets rid of the heads of the families who personally want to destroy him without going for regime change, without trying to change the character of the family himself, but waiting for a new person to emerge. And as we see at the beginning of Godfather 2, there is a new equilibrium, that the new guys have been told, if you come along with us, you benefit by Vegas gambling, by living in a stable order, by getting things done, and if you try to destroy me in a revolutionary way, I'm coming after you. And that now make your decision. I can't make your choice for you. You have to make your choice, not in Washington, not at the IMF, but in Tehran, in North Korea. But let me be clear, if you're going to go after me, I'm coming after you. What I would argue, though, that Obama needs to do in the case of Iran and North Korea is go through the motions of another series of negotiations and put the pressure on the Europeans in the case of Iran, the Russians as well, the Gulf states, and in the case of China, being the key interlocutor with North Korea, and say, look, we've gone the extra mile. We've done absolutely everything we could do. Now you can see that this can't work, so now I need your help to manage this rogue state because this ain't going to go away. That's the next step that never gets done in this process. That has to get done.
Well, see, here's my concern, to kind of go back to it with what you're saying, is that in the old rules of statecraft, you know, first of all, it was kind of crazy to think that any one power could even come close to destroying the United States. So that America is not as vulnerable as the Corleone family in that respect if you go back to the old rules. Post 9/11, we learn that, you know, because of our interconnectedness and because of all kinds of other things, and I'm thinking about sort of cyber attacks as well, that I would think that there would be a consensus among realist neoconservatives and liberal institutionalists that we need a state system that is capable of dealing with these subnational threats, which are more serious than we thought they were before 9/11. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I would entirely agree with that.
Okay, and
they're
one
of a basket of issues. Absolutely. And in fact, Eli, I go further. This is actually a carrot to get this sub-state system, to get this condominium of powers working together. Because the only way this thing is going to work is if we actually solve problems. A fact I never get tired of telling my European friends. I've been arguing about the same things in Europe for 10 years now. Mm-hmm. Nothing has changed. I can do the first 27 moves in the Balkans in my head. And nothing happens. It's how many angels can you put on the head of a pin? It's a little St. Augustine thing going on.
Sure.
And what we need to do is think the way, exactly that way, is say, let's look at issues. We're not going to agree with the Chinese about the nature of man, about the role of the state in society, about all kinds of things that matter. Where we are going to agree about the Chinese is that al-Qaeda are an irredentist force that want to destroy you as much as they want to destroy us. And you've got a real stake in the western part of your country in not having this come unglued, because territorial unity is one of the reasons you're here at the ball game. This is vital, and I would certainly agree that asymmetric warfare has been a far more important issue than we thought it was before 9/11, even if still think, absolutely, and that we haven't thought nearly enough of this, any of the states, and that this is a basis to work together to set up this new system, which, again, systems only work when they're based on solving real problems. And so this is one of a series of issues that we say absolutely should be addressed, along with the economic crisis, along with al-Qaeda, along with worrying about in the future, as you say, these transnational issues, that even if we have sovereigntists running India, Brazil, Russia, and China, and that's a whole other issue, that the rising powers are far more sovereigntist than even America, which drives the Europeans absolutely crazy. But it isn't going to be some merging of sovereignty. It's going to be talking about common interests and then moving forward from there.
And
that's
the only way
things can get done.
We need a system, whether it's how we patrol the seas.
That's another great example.
Right. Yep. We need a system to make sure that al-Qaeda or future Dr. Evils don't get, you know, radioactive material. Right.
Because they could blow up Moscow or Beijing just as easily as Washington.
Right. Exactly.
That's right. Yeah. We agree
now,
with that.
Part of that state system, I think I would argue, and I think the liberal internationalists and neoconservatives would argue, is that if you don't necessarily get full-on democracy, but but you do need a level of transparency. Because while we can understand that it is in the state interest of large powers to necessarily work as good faith actors in such a state system to make sure that, you know, you control the flow of sensitive, you know, nuclear material and, for that matter, sensitive code or expertise in terms of computer viruses and things like this. But then you have other states that are going to have to be part of it as well. And you can't allow for states to be, on the one hand, sort of getting the recognition of being part of a state system, but then also aligning themselves as part of their statecraft. As I think Iran is a great example, and North Korea are a great example, and frankly, Iraq, the Axis of Evil, is a good example. All of these states were, on the one hand, you know, they had representatives at the UN, and they were, you know, recognized as states. On the other hand, they were part of the forces that would bring down the state system itself. And I think that the neoconservative insight is that in order to have a functioning international system, you need to exclude certain powers, not great powers. I don't think anybody at this point would argue, or at least seriously argue.
But they did, Eli. I think now it's a much more refined ism, neoconservatism, than it used to be, which is a point we make in the book. I think earlier there was an undifferentiated quality to both liberal institutionalism and neoconservatism, which is bring them all on to Syria, on to Beijing, I remember hearing when I was in Washington. You don't hear that anymore. I would agree. I think by failures, I think there is a refining process going on. And as I said, the key realist insight, which I think can be certainly be shared, is to know the difference between rival great powers that you're going to have to do business with, as Michael would, because that's, as he said, the business we've chosen. I live in a state system. I don't get to pick who runs Beijing. I wish I did, but I don't, and so it's a waste of time to do that. And in fact, it's counterproductive to lump together rival powers and the Dr. Evil powers. To lump them all together, well, that will make every rival power do what? Try to
side with these subscribe. I would agree with you. Don't lump them in. But my problem is that Clinton and even George H.W. Reagan, I mean, people, the U.S. government has recognized for some time preponderance of these kinds of rogue regimes. And for years, European powers and China just saw that as, another emerging market, as if these things didn't matter. And my point is that after 9/11, we have to understand that, when you include in the state system places that are playing the other side of it, then you imperil us all. And so the other side of that is that you need to sort of kind of sit down and say to the Germans, you know what, maybe the refined blast furnaces that you're selling to the Iranians.
Not such a good idea. Yeah.
But I agree with you. You can't have a Jacobin approach to international relations whereby you're right. You don't want to conflate rival powers with revolutionary power.
Because you'll get nowhere, because the rival powers, by definition, will side with it, a la The Godfather, where the Barzinis and the Tattaglias, Sonny says, take them all on, we'll take them all on. And Tom's like, really one of the best scenes in the movie, Tom and Robert Duvall and James Caan, both wonderful actors, screaming at each other.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Tom's like, but business is going to hurt. You don't understand. By saying everyone's equally wrong in an undifferentiated way, you're throwing everyone together, and then they are going to stop us at every single international level, as you say, working together in any way, in an ad hoc way through international institutions, at a state level, anyway, of course they're not going to work with us if we lump them all together. But let's be fair, the Democrats have been no better, the Tom Hagens are no better, intervening in Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, many liberal institutionalists being in favor of all of these without once mentioning how any of these serve the national interest.
Just, well, we intervened. That's a separate kind of question.
But in a way, it's not, Eli, because the key point is that there is an undifferentiated quality. There is an undifferentiated. We just do this. And if you do this in any case, you're going to end up with complexities that exist in the real world that don't fit nicely into this. And, I mean, Sonny unleashes a gangland war where a lot of these powers come back at him. I think there has been a refining of some neoconservatives, and you don't hear China mentioned anymore. You don't even hear Russia mentioned in the same way. I think there's a much more realistic view of Russia. Frankly, I'm terrified by Russia's weakness, that it might do something really stupid like go into the Crimea and say, here we are, and change the subject from the fact the stock market lost 80% of its value last year.
Right.
That's what worries me, is that there are not enough in the system. And as a result of this, And not because I love them, but as a result of this, they've got far less to lose, are far more dangerous than the Chinese, an immediate threat. And boy, if I were advising Putin, walking into the Crimea where no one's going to do anything and changing the subject from the economic problems you have, that doesn't sound like such a bad idea. And that terrifies me. If I can figure that out, so can some Russians.
Well, and also we're worried that the Russians are going to sell rogue states, these missile defense system or other sorts of things. And yes, we need to kind of figure out a way to bring them along. I just think that the liberal institutionalists and neoconservatives would argue that I might not be the right avatar of neoconservatism, because I'm now I have no interest in large U.S. programs promoting democracy in other parts of the world. If somebody could, I don't see any reason why that role could not be done more effectively by non-government organizations. So there is, I think, a point in which a U.S.
ambassador... Or people within the countries, Eli, themselves. I mean, let's
be clear. Well, that's what I'm saying.
Capitalism leads to
right.
pluralism, I believe, in the middle-class argument. That's the bet with the Chinese. That's the 50-100-year bet. They think they can have authoritarian capitalism. I think the middle class are going to demand pluralism, as they have throughout history. We're all polite to each other at cocktail parties, but that's the gamble we've both taken. I'm very comfortable with that gamble. What I'm not comfortable with is government. I'm a Republican, and I thought we were against social engineering. I mean, that's why I joined the party.
NGOs can nurture. I mean, I hate to give Soros any credit.
Yeah,
I will give George Soros credit for, after the fall of the Soviet Union, his organization, the Open Society Institute, did a lot of work in nurturing and providing original seed money for movements that ended up becoming democratizing forces in places like Georgia.
But the key, Eli, and you're right, and the key point, though, is, and this is what the neocons and liberal institutionalists forgot for a long while, they have to be organic movements. They have to be them.
Yeah, yeah.
We can help them help themselves, to use the old Victorian adage. That absolutely, and we should do that, through NGOs, through the spread of capitalism, through face-to-face contacts, through everything. But we cannot add water and get George Washington,
let me turn it on the realists. Sometimes the realists think that the world is a little bit too staid. And there's a wonderful anecdote in Mark Palmer's book where he talks about how he's meeting with Jim Baker right before George H.W. Bush is going to meet some of these democracy activists in Hungary. And Baker says, you know, these people are never going to run the country. And then it turns out, of course, 4 months later, Hungarians have a real election, and the people that George H.W. Bush met were running the country. So there are times when an ambassador, at the right moment, when there is an organic movement, can make a lot of difference. I mean, our ambassador in Chile, attending a funeral during the last days of Pinochet, of a young kind of boy who was murdered by security forces, and I'm sorry, I don't know all the details of it, but these kind of symbolic events can make a big difference. We just have to understand that U.S. State Department analysts are not going to be the authors of a democratic movement.
And Eli, that's the key point. That's the key realist insight. It's got to be organic. Once you have an organic movement, you can be very creative in nurturing it. But it must be organic, not believing exiles about how much legitimacy they have in countries they haven't been to since 1958, as was true with Chalabi.
Chalabi in the 1990s spent a lot of time in northern Iraq.
But Eli, he had no legitimacy when the parliamentary elections were held. His great promises of this groundswell for him didn't occur.
I'm going to go toe to toe with you on this, Holzman. I mean, you're putting me in a weird position because I've been critical of a lot of things about Chalabi. But keep in mind, after the U.S. policy was to keep him out of the interim government of Iyad Alawi, who was believed to have the legitimacy that Chalabi lacked, Chalabi formed the United Iraqi Alliance, which ended up becoming and is to this day the ruling party. And his job in 2005 was to be
a small
the deputy
part of the
prime
ruling
minister.
Party
it wasn't a
small part of the ruling party. Look, the point is, in Iraq, we were picking winners and losers, as we did with Alawi. Eli, we were picking winners and losers. And when you pick winners and losers, you move away from the organic notion, where I think you do find agreement across the board. That is the key insight of all this, is that we can't make something grow that isn't there, but what we can do is nurture things that actually exist. And we should do that. And I think we can continue to do that. But we cannot pick winners and losers because we're not very good at it.
But in the case of Iraq and the particularly sadistic Saddam Hussein, you had a flight of every talented Iraqi, you know, first because of the Ba'athist coups in the late 19, the Ba'athist coup in 1979, and then later because of you know, because of the sanctions regime after he invaded Kuwait. And you did have a very talented Iraqi diaspora that that has come back, and in a lot of cases, you know, I'm not, I would put it to you this way. I would ask you, would you rather have, would you trade the U.S. relationship today, in 2009, with the Iraqi military and the Iraqi security services for the same relationship that we have with the Pakistani security services and the Pakistani?
I think this is getting far afield. I would say this. I would like my $1 trillion back from the war. I would like Iran not to be the dominant power in the Gulf, which is what the invasion has made happen, very obviously. There are three powers in the Gulf. There aren't enough Saudis. So if you take out the regime in Iraq, you've just made your enemies, the Islamic Republic, the dominant power in the Gulf. That, to me, is a strategic disaster.
But we had when the policy was dual containment with Iraq and Iran, you had a very real nuclear program, obviously, in Iran that they didn't tell us about, and at least the perception that Iraq, you know, because they did not comply with any of the inspectors, so you had also an unstable situation there. And as you know, and Saddam Hussein had made it very clear, sort of my definition of the rogue actors, that he was willing to, and he had at different times aligned with the various enemies of the international system in the Middle East, and the currents of international terrorism. As I think that I would point to the IDA report, which is a very revealing look at the Ba'athist archives. And I'd say that certainly in 2005 and 2006, the Iraq war looked like an enormous blunder. And but I think it looks different today, and I think the trajectory it's on, you could see. I think you could see as
Eli. Let's talk more about the book. We just don't agree. I think that we went in, spent $1 trillion, made a terrible mess, left Iran dominant in the Gulf, closer to its nuclear program. I think this cost us all over the world in terms of goodwill and actors willing to work with us. I think that this was an unmitigated disaster. Far less of one because General Petraeus, and back to the point of legitimacy, the one bright spot in all this, and I know and really respect him, is that he saw the indigenous movement of the Sons of Iraq, the awakening against al-Qaeda, because they were beheading people in the streets, because they were hurting them locally, these foreigners coming in and imposing, again, alien customs upon the local people. And Petraeus says, aha, organic movement, this is based upon real things that I can understand and can push and aren't going away, and takes advantage of this. And that, to me, has been the wonderful moment of statecraft in the whole thing. Which did make a terrible situation less terrible. I would entirely agree with that. But again, that's back to my point of working with what's on the ground. And he did see that. But that is, to me, the success here. Geostrategically, I think it's still a terrible blunder. And I think most Americans would like their $1 trillion back right now.
Well, I mean, the $1 trillion back, let's table for a second. But I think that for your side of the argument, then you would have to say that you think that you would have rather seen Saddam or Uday or Qusay in charge of Iraq today, which and nothing happening in that regard, as than what we're seeing now, which is five successive national elections and a military that we actually have something more than a leader-to-leader relationship with. We actually know in a meaningful sense. And we finally, I think, also have, because we came in some ways, we aligned at the right moment with the Sons of Iraq and the Anbar tribes, you now have, you know, a real victory against Salafism and a real victory against Al-Qaeda, and you have it with an Arab
Eli,
Sunni
I'll
base.
I'll believe this a lot more when the Kurds vote for people who aren't Kurdish, when the Shia vote for people who aren't Shia, and the Sunnis vote for people who aren't Sunni. Then I'll.
Well, you've got a bet with China. I've got a bet with Iraq.
Right, and we'll have a beer on this one, because I think Iraq will come unraveled. China's more. We'll be old men when, by the time we do that bet. Iraq, yeah. I see nothing different from the 1920s, where exactly the same situation happened. I'm just finishing a book on Lawrence of Arabia, and exactly the same ethno-religious patterns and breakdown were there when Faisal was installed as king from outside, when he had no legitimacy. And I see no difference. There were 29 coups in the 29 years they were in the country.
Right, but we didn't install a king.
Did we not?
Well, is Maliki in, oh, did we install Maliki? I mean, I don't think we did. I remember he won an election. He's gone against us at times too. I mean,
I don't think that Maliki has anything approaching broad-based national support, nor do I think Iraqis in quotations around that country. I think Sunni, Shia, and Kurds do, which are sub-state actors. I don't think it's a nation state in the sense that I would use the term.
You don't think Iraq is a nation? Okay, well,
no.
We'll see. I'm betting on I think these institutions, after defeating the forces that tried to sabotage them, including their neighbor Iran, the fact, you know, it's a bit like Hezbollah can win in Lebanon by surviving, because, you know what I'm saying? Even though you can make an argument that in 2006 Israel did a lot of damage to Hezbollah's infrastructure, but actually Hezbollah
didn't matter.
Won the war.
That's
didn't
right.
matter because Hezbollah survived.
And they looked like they won merely because they got up out of the rubble and said,
right.
We're still here.
I think a similar dynamic exists for Iraqi institutions. That if Iraqi institutions, and you continue to see these elections and so forth, survive, then that's a victory simply because they continue to exist.
I would agree with you to the point that as the Americans withdraw, it will become very clear, and by clear in a 5 to 10 year relatively quick period in historical terms, as to whether these things have the ultimate success for nation building or failure is are things you set up self-sustaining or not after you leave.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's
the metric. And
right,
and
right.
If in 5 years, make it 7 or 8, because things can go. If in 8 years, 2 presidential terms, we're even where we are now, I'll buy you the beer.
All right, fair enough.
And
do you want to go back to the book?
Sure, why not?
Yes, okay. All right, so let me make some pedantic points here.
Okay.
It's a very pedantic.
Okay.
And I'm quoting here. You say, I would not put in Norman Podaritz and Michael Ledeen in the same category as the shoot first, ask questions later approach.
I know both of them, and I'm very confident doing that.
Okay, and here's why I would say that they're different. Podaritz has said he wants to bomb Iran yesterday. See, I think he first said it in 2006. And Ledeen has argued for a kind of democratic revolution in Iran, or to support what he thinks are the indigenous and organic forces of democratic revolution.
Right.
So those, I think, are two important distinctions between those two guys. That was one minor criticism I had.
It's very minor.
This is one reference.
I've often testified before Congress with Ledeen, and I remember putting that in. The one time we put that in. Okay, go on.
Okay. And it's a few pages later, and this is an issue. I got to tell you, this is not just me. This is it's not just you, I should say. But can we stop calling neoconservatives ex-Trotskyites? I mean, it's like Michael Lind and Sidney Blumenthal started this, and it's true if you want to go back to
I've read on neoconservatism, yeah.
Okay, but I don't think today's neoconservatives have anything to do with Trotsky's. And coming from you, it's a little different, John, because you're a Republican. But when I hear it from Democrats about Trotsky, it just drives me up a wall. I'm like, you were going to accuse me of being a commie. Come on.
No, I mean, let me make the point right there about that. It's the permanent revolution point. And back to the Jacobin point, my criticism, and yes, it's refined. Krauthammer, for instance, has backed off a good deal from where he was with the Unipolar Moment articles, if you read him now on, we've got to somehow link up realist national interest concerns with my democratic concerns. That's jeteing back a good half step, okay? I'm aware of that. But at the time when this thing was going, there was this notion of permanent revolution, which to me was the link there. And again, I do agree Sid Vicious and some of the Dems added that in. I added that in because I saw a modus operandi that really, as a conservative, as a Burkean, and you know I am, as a Burkean, disturbed me. Make it Jacobin. That was precisely what the world isn't like that. And again, conflating things together that aren't. And there, Podaritz and Ledeen, that would be the point of thing. Yes, the way they go about it is different. I give you that. You're absolutely right. But there is, and I've talked to Michael a lot and enjoyed it, but there is this lack, this lumping together of people that I don't think should be lumped together. And the problem with doing that is that you get these countervailing forces if you assume that there's only one motive force in history rather than many. Which is what
well,
I assume.
I would just, I mean, on this dialogue, I would just simply say that if neoconservative is to mean anything, it is just, I would say, a migration from left to right. And not, I mean, you don't really get into it, though. I don't like. I know I'm not a big fan of the Sonny, but I see where you're coming from in the respect of the early aughts on that. But I would just say that it's just neoconservative. You know, just means people who used to be more on the left have gone to the right, and that would include a lot of people. In that respect, and I think that's kind of where it is at this point. And
but
I think
doesn't that explain, Eli, the social engineering point? Is that they've always been comfortable, the neoconservatives, with social engineering, and most of the Republican Party, where they before their migration, were not very comfortable with that. And going back to Jefferson, the Jefferson Adams arguments, where Adams says, you know, I'm totally for democracy, but maybe there are some unique French cultural things that are going to make this turn into the terror. And Jefferson saying, no, it's the same everywhere. And Adams saying, well, wait a minute. It's not. By the way, I have a picture of both of them on my wall at home, so I love them.
No,
both.
Adams is my favorite founding father.
I love Adams because he's the one saying, I know it's unfashionable, but I just think France culturally has this utopian tradition that's going to make some of these things that you and I like really, really scary. And he was right. I think
and he's also corresponding with Lafayette, who is purged by the French Revolution.
Who's writing him from jail, saying these guys are insane. They're not for liberal democracy. They're fundamentally illiberal. Be careful about that in the name of democracy. And Adams gets this, and Jefferson goes off on his swoon for Robespierre and Danton and Saint-Just and all these lunatics, these whack jobs. And I would just say that's the danger of social engineering. That's I cannot remake other societies. I'm humble enough to really hope I can help with American policy. What I can do, and where you and I agree, is talk about issues. What I can do is nurture organic movements that seem to me to benefit the United States in the long run. What I can do is make symbolic gestures, and we should, reminding people of what we stand for. We should do that all the time. But what I also think we should do is then see the world as it is, warts and all, and try to make it better from there, rather than imagining a democratic world, a purely democratic world, a Kantian paradise that, frankly, in 4,000 years of recorded history, has never existed.
Well, yes, but it's an ideal to work for, and I just think that the neoconservative and frankly,
start
liberal
with the real and move to the ideal. That's a conservative thing. I mean, but don't start with the ideal and be disappointed. And by the way, actually make the real harder and worse.
Sometimes realism is oversimplified, is to sort of say that you just don't care how a country is governed. And I think that I would say...
I do care. No, I would disagree. I do care. What I'm saying is I can't change it in every case. I would like it if China were run by philosopher kings, but it's not. But it doesn't mean I still don't have to work with them. Tomorrow morning, I'm buying treasury bills at a loss for the next, 8 years, so the American economy can go by. That's the world I live in, and I have to work that way. I only worry about the things, as Marcus Aurelius put it, that I can change. I don't worry about things that I can't.
Okay. Well, and I would – that's why maybe I'm not the best avatar, because I'm much more of the view that there's a limit to what the U.S. government can do in terms of democracy promotion as a central part of the policy. But that said, I still recognize that the international system would work better if its participants had the level of transparency that open societies afford.
No, absolutely. And again, back to the China bluff. I mean, we don't live in a democratic world. We've spent a lot of time talking about that. I think the neocons got this wrong, because we do live in a world that has one economic system at the moment, which is extraordinary. Yeah. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. It isn't feudal, where every little feudal empire was run economically entirely differently, or even the Cold War, where we've got this weird quasi-fake socialism thing going on.
Right.
Everybody. You don't have to convince the Chinese capitalism works. I don't waste time lecturing them about that. In fact, they're lecturing us about that now. I've lived to see that day, which is amazing. You know, no, you better be fiscally responsible and not inflate away our investments. I've lived to see a Chinese leader talk about that, and that's a great success of American diplomacy again. But we do live in a system that is entirely capitalistic. If we want the change that we're talking about, I would argue to look again at this notion of using capitalism as the Trojan horse to reach these changes over a longer period of time, but a more secure, organic system, because middle classes in China now don't like that their rivers are polluted, that airplanes fly over them, that the local corrupt official needs a bribe to get things done, and they're beginning to organize and complain about it. And in some cases, they're winning, because there is a terror among the center there that they could lose control of this thing. That, to me, is the great long-term bet. We do live in a capitalistic system. Bind them closer and closer to us. As Michael said, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. that's the way forward.
Well, yes. I guess the only thing I have, your point about capitalism is that sometimes, however, as I just recently wrote about, capitalism means that you sell a state like Iran a kind of NSA monitoring system.
Eli, I totally agree with you. And we should always have military controls on what we sell, and that is a decision in our country that we should absolutely make, and there should be limits on it. I'm not for unfettered Vanderbilt capitalism with the Chinese.
Okay. Yeah,
Or with
and
almost anybody
way, that
else.
That was the big fight in the 80s, if you remember, with Richard Pearl and other realists and Armitage on both sides of that. Richard Pearl wanted to have this regime established. You know, he wanted to. He saw, I guess, Wassenaar and other arms and other kind of technology transfer regimes crumbling, and he wanted to strengthen these things. And that was the sort of, you know, that doesn't mean that Richard Pearl in that case was against capitalism. He's very much of a capitalist, but it just
indeed
means that,
a good one.
Yes, a good one. All right, well, I guess this has been a very good dialogue. I would end it by saying I always thought of Adams as the first neocon, because if you go back to his letters to Abigail, he's always talking about how...
Oh, you're not getting him, but I want to hear your argument, because I think he's the ultimate realist, so go on.
He's the ultimate neoconservative, because, well, here's my argument. One is if you look at his debates in the Continental Congress with the Quaker delegation for Revolutionary War... And separation from England.
John Dickinson.
And his argument about no middle way, in some ways, is very, very kind of, you could see the echoes of that later on in some of the Weekly Standard articles about Iraq. Second of all, he writes that his favorite committee is the Naval Committee, and he's obsessed with military affairs as somebody who is himself not a soldier. And in many ways, you know, his political fortunes are in the kind of reflected glory of George Washington, who he attaches himself to, and he becomes the great advocate in the Continental Congress for Washington in the same way that neoconservatives became the advocate for Petraeus in the U.S. Congress. And at the end of the day, I kind of resent the Jefferson analogy, because, I mean, I agree with conservatives about the French Revolution, and I think that you can find more nuance, especially now, among neoconservatives, so that's not necessarily the opposite.
I mean, I'm gonna go for this, Eli, because I'm glad we both like this. This is great. I'm actually having a discussion about John Adams. I have the Gilbert Stuart picture on my wall at home. Look, Adams always was about the lack of social engineering, which is a realist and not a neocon trait. He's constantly on the defensive, saying things like, you know, that sounds wonderful in theory. He'd listen to Jefferson even say all men are created equal and say, that's a wonderful theory, but come on, it's not true. Every man should have equal rights, should have equal opportunities. And they get into this immediately during the drafting of the Continental Congress. He's about the fallibility of man, about the limits of social engineering, all the way along his career, quite consistently, often when it's not in his interests. If he'd gone to war with France in the undeclared naval war, he could well have been reelected. He doesn't do this. He stands out against the French Revolution when it's wildly fashionable with Citizen Genet and Jefferson.
We were divided as a nation on the French Revolution. There were plenty of British...
There were, but there are also vast demonstrations in the streets against Washington, frankly, the only ones there ever were against Washington over the Jay Treaty. But what we really get is Jefferson saying, the American and the French Revolution are the same. They are the same. They are democratic revolutions, and that this will take over the world, and that this is why we should support it. Yes, bad things are going on there. Yes, I wish it had been run more like the way we ran it, but Mr. Adams, we're longtime friends, and you've got to come along with me on this one because it's the furtherance of the ideology that we both believe in. Adams says, no, that's not the case, because our revolution came out of a very specific cultural instance that made us a city on a hill. He goes, as you rightly say, with Washington and with Hamilton in saying, out of these very unique circumstances that God, in the case of what they thought Providence, thought should happen, America has been lucky enough to have this liberal democratic tradition. The French have a very different set of circumstances, and even if in the long run they are going to become democratic, to expect it to happen this quickly and this immediately is absolutely a mistake. And to me, this is where Adams and Jefferson are the realist neocon argument, and I heard this over and over again in my head as I went through the decisions I had to make when I was leaving Washington. I think that Adams
have
has
you,
got
have
to be
you
the
seen
model.
Though Adams's like case for revolution on the floor of the Connecticut?
No, I have. I mean, with John Dickinson.
Yeah.
But again, Adams is saying on certain issues, and again relating specifically to the United States and the specific cultural historical milieu it's in, he makes that case. We've got to go for it. He's every bit as zealous as Jefferson, in many ways more so. John Dickinson is the enemy, who's saying there's this middle ground, and
right,
I'm a Quaker,
right.
And yeah, absolutely. But but that's about America, which Adams clearly knew. He'd been a pretty good ambassador in the Netherlands, a pretty lousy one in France, but he did know enough about the rest of the world to know that he didn't know.
Well,
everything
do you blame
about.
You blame Adams for France, or do you blame Franklin, who's just
I blame Franklin. I don't blame,
I blame
Adams
Franklin
at all.
Too, yeah.
Yeah, Adams got the brunt end of that stick, I'm afraid. But bottom line, he sees the difference. He sees that states and cultures and ethnologies and sociologies are different, and that you should proceed very carefully and very humbly in trying to craft ideology onto other peoples about whom you know very little.
Well,
to me, that's the fundamental realist insight that Adams would share.
That would be
my difference in your argument.
Well, the Bernard Lewis, who I guess is considered a neoconservative or is acquired by neoconservatives, made his whole career on the differences between cultures and the fine nuances in that respect. And on the social engineering point, I guess I don't believe in social engineering either, and I know plenty of neoconservatives who don't, and so I almost don't want to necessarily accept that. And I would say that at least
Boy,
in the grand
find me, that, find me one who doesn't believe in it in any place they want to take over. I mean, to me that's a fundamental disagreement.
Okay, well, I mean, and finally, I would argue that you have to say that Adams is a neoconservative and is anti-Quakerism. On just the point of his anti-Quakerism, I think that you'd have to say that Adams is the neocon.
I think that on the point of independence, he knows that there is no middle ground at this point, but I think that is a different argument than the foreign affairs argument about the French Revolution, precisely because Adams is a particularist. As realists should be, that in this particular situation, 150 years of imperial neglect, then they try to reimpose control after the French and Indian War to pay off the debt. That is a specific situation that the French don't share, so we need to be very cautious about moving forward to saying we can graft an ideology or help graft an ideology even onto another culture, of which Adams, who knew more about France than lots and lots of people, but he even admitted that he knew not enough to be able to do that. And to me, that is a fundamental. And as you and I are arguing, this is an argument that's been around since the beginning of time. We say in the book that you know, we don't think neoconservatism, one of the arguments against it that I don't like is that it's this new thing that nobody's ever talked about, this artificial in quotations thing. This is an argument that's been around between the three basic schools since the founding of the Republic.
Yes,
this is
very long,
very storied, very historical, very interesting, endlessly fascinating argument. And what we really wanted to do in the book, to bring it back to the book, is bring it up to date for what we see as the new multipolar world, and do so using ideas and soft power that actually affect more people than the 27 of us who work and live in Washington.
I would say that it's a good book to get if you're a general interest viewer, because it's something that is written for the average reader, and it's a short book. It's the size of a passport, as you can see. It's about the size. It's a little larger, but it looks like a passport. It's something that, you know, if you're taking a trip, you know, to Europe or somewhere else, that you can read it on the plane, and it gives you a lot to think about.
Well, thank you. That was exactly our goal, as we put it, the train ride. I read Kagan's book, actually, and I'll say this, modeling it. I read Kagan's book between New York and Washington on the train, because the train got stuck halfway. And I read the book and didn't notice it, and I thought, and I will say this, the neocons of all the three schools have been the best at reaching out to the broader audience, and rather than bitch about them, as so many do among the realist movement, I thought, why don't we beat them at their own game? If they can write this well and appeal to people, perhaps we should stop talking at national interest to each other and talk to a broader audience. That surely was part of the impetus, along with Ken Branagh and the Shakespeare point I made.
Very good. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Pleasure talking to you, Elon.
Okay,
take
okay,
care.
Right.
When I'm home, let's have a drink and we'll argue more about
Absolutely.
Adams. That's fantastic.
Maybe
that you love
in Berlin. Yes.
All right. Okay, count it in. Take care.
Thanks.